We're still preparing some amendments.
Okay.
And
I will not be here on Thursday, just FYI.
With that, I think we'll do the committee measures, introduction of committee measures right now. And now we're going to do a introduction of some committee bills, and I will entertain a motion on those.
Madam Chair, I would move to introduce the following legislative concept as committee measures. LC 2563, dated 1/21/2015, and LC 3311, dated 2/11/2015.
Representative Rayfield has moved to introduce LC 2563, dated January 21st, 2015, and LC 3311, dated February 11th, 2015, as committee measures. Is there any discussion? Just as a reminder, allowing these to be introduced as committee measures is not any reflection on your support for the substance of the bill, just allowing them to be committee measures. So is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2377. And Cheryl, go ahead and come forward, and Wendy will give us a description of the bill.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2377 prohibits a person from soliciting, requesting, or otherwise inducing another person to provide personal information by impersonating a third person without that third person's knowledge, authorization, and consent. The bill creates exceptions for law enforcement and lawful investigators. The violations of this law would be punished as an unlawful trade practice. The bill declares an emergency and is effective upon passage. The bill's been found to have no revenue impact. It may have a fiscal impact. The statement has not yet been issued, and there are no amendments at this time.
Thank you. Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm an assistant attorney general at the Oregon Department of Justice. As you know, the Department of Justice enforces the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, the Maine Consumer Protection Law. And occasionally we come up with patterns or practices we find alarming and come to you for some ideas to change the law. House Bill 2377 is what we've been calling our anti-phishing bill. No, that's not the rod and reel phishing. This is email phishing with a PH. Basically, fraudsters send out legitimate-looking emails, something similar to that, and try to induce consumers into giving over personal information, whether that be financial or otherwise. This is a big problem all across our country and all over the world, really. Verizon does a yearly report about problems they see online. And a couple years ago, phishing was number 9. It's now bumped up to number 3. So this is a very very much a growing problem, and there's a reason it has been growing. It's successful. 18% of these emails get a click-through, meaning somebody takes the bait. To give you some context, in normal marketing emails, the click-through rate is 3%, so these are very successful. Why are they so high? Well, usually because consumers really can't protect against what they don't understand. And so what they'll do here is target those who don't understand how email works, don't understand how the internet works. And I kind of make an analogy to banking, the banking industry. I have a friend who's a teller, and basically part of her training was to sit in a room with cash for a day. And she felt it, she looked at it, she smelled it, right? She got used to what legitimate cash looks like. So when something counterfeit comes in, even before she's consciously thinking about it, there's something in her subconscious that says, wait, this feels off. The analogy here is, most of our vulnerable consumers maybe aren't all that tech savvy, aren't used to how the internet works, and so they don't have that instinct to say, wait a minute, something looks off. So I give you an example from our consumer protection hotline and database. This came in, I think, about a year ago. And this gentleman had been selling some things online successfully, and then he got this email from something called Amazon product ads. And it said, great news, you've been doing well, there's $19,000 waiting for you, just give us your banking information and $3,000 and we can release that $19,000 into your account. So he says, oh, you know, this could be a scam, but look, it's got Amazon.com Inc. on the bottom from Seattle, yep, that's where they're based. And then he got the account statement right, and there's the Amazon logo, and this is looking pretty good. But when I got this complaint, obviously I had the advantage of there's been fraud here, but I looked at it and said, okay, wait a minute. We've got jamie.ben.amazon@gmail, Google, Amazon, kind of competitors here. And Amazon, I'm sure, has their own at amazon.com. In fact, I know they do. Also, what I found, there's the Amazon logo, right? But then it says under it, an Amazon services product. What exactly is that? I've never seen the gray part under their logo before. It's sideways. That's off. So my instincts kicked in because I'm a child of our current age, but those with less experience with the internet wouldn't catch that. Just for comparison, you know, here's real Amazon services, and you can sell things through Amazon and so forth. But instinctually, I just see that that's off, and that doesn't always happen with our most vulnerable consumers. So the fix here, basically, there's 23 other states, I believe, that already have anti-phishing laws specifically. We do have our unlawful trade practices, which addresses some fraudulent practices, but not specifically phishing. And that's what this fix would do, is just basically put that language specifically in there to go after this specific behavior. And that's it, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Right.
Yeah.
I was just curious, how often do you catch folks that send out these emails? Because I get a lot of these emails. I mean, mostly they're not from the United States when they're emailing me, so I was just kind of curious.
Yeah, Chair Fagan, Representative Rayfield, enforcement is tricky. You know, we've been talking to other states that are going after this problem, and sometimes what happens is they send out basically a subpoena, and it hits, you know, the end of our borders, and there's not much we can do. I was at a conference last summer on cyber crimes, and I was talking with somebody from the Orange County cyber crimes unit, and she said something interesting in that, you know, it's always going to be happening overseas, but it's maybe dying down a little bit because it's not so trendy to do this anymore overseas. And so she called them script kiddies in states are now picking this up. Just the, you know, the less sophisticated fraudsters, if you will, are kind of picking up on this in-state, and she expected to see a rise within state, which means we could get after it a little bit better.
So. Other questions? Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 2377?
No. Okay.
Well, with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2377. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2794. And there's Mr. Parrish. Wendy, can you give us a description of this?
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2794 prohibits a person other than an authorized reseller from selling admission tickets to entertainment events if the operator of the events has not released admission tickets for sale. The bill requires resellers other than an authorized reseller to have access to and show to potential customers a current inventory of unsold tickets. The bill declares an emergency and is effective upon passage. It's been found to have no revenue impact. It may have a fiscal impact. A statement has not yet been issued, and there are no amendments at this time.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, and once again on a consumer protection bill, which, again, not normally something I bring forward. But in 2013, Representative Williams and I brought forward House Bill 3510. And the goal was this. This came out of some constituent complaints. Representative Williamson has Keller Auditorium, and some of the theaters are in her district. I have constituents who go frequent those things. And if you were to do a search right now for Keller Auditorium on on your web. The very first site that you're going to come up is with a site that is not Killer Auditorium. Looks like Killer Auditorium uses their floor plan to sell tickets to events. Has no relationship with Killer Auditorium. Has no relationship with the talent who is going to the auditorium, and is a lot of times selling tickets that haven't been released by Killer Auditorium for sale to the public. This goal is not a goal to a bill to regulate the internet. I have very strong feelings about state legislatures who try to come in and solve internet issues, which I believe are interstate commerce issues. But what this bill does do in its current form or in its proposed amendment form, and there are some folks who represent organizations like StubHub who want to see an amendment that kind of really clarifies that you could still do sort of Rose Garden seats for a Blazers game and would like to be able to sell those tickets, that the goal of this bill is not to end ticket scalping. I mean, people can still do that. The law is very clear, and cases around that have been very clear about being able to sell a ticket that you have for a marked up price over face value. This bill doesn't say that you can't put your ad, ticket on Craigslist. But what we're really trying to get to is those folks on the internet who otherwise are sort of scamming the public into thinking that if you buy a ticket right now, essentially what they're doing is sort of an arbitrage type deal of going in and trying to get that ticket bought after the ticket becomes released. And so when this bill was coming forward in 2013, Michael Boublier, I guess that's how you say his last name, was slated to go and perform at the Rose Garden in November. Some of these types of sites were already selling the tickets. They hadn't even inked the deal. The Rose Garden hadn't even inked the deal with the talent, and yet there were already people out there selling these tickets for an inflated cost. And again, this bill's not about the cost. It's about, do you have the right to sell something that you don't even own, and sort of this scamming of consumers. And again, the goal isn't to regulate the internet. What this bill does is puts language into our statutes that say you can't do that, and then we give a group like Keller or the Rose Garden the ability to go to a search engine who's placing those ads, or Google AdWords or Yahoo or Facebook ads, and say, hey, this actually violates your terms of service. Our state law violates your terms of service. Can you not run those ads? And it would actually give those your big search engines the ability to look at those types of ads and say, you are violating our terms of service. We're just going to shut that ad down. This does not do anything in terms of giving, you know, broad sweeping reach to the AG or anything like that. We are just trying to clarify that these type of ticket sales, if you don't have the ticket in hand, you can't sell something that you don't have, and give the ability again for a Keller or, in fact, all of the venues in the state, and a lot of us have venues in our district. Folks from Bend came, the folks from Eugene came, they all came and said, and got together in this building and said, we have got to do something about this, and this is probably about the most sort of elegant way we can do that without something that would violate interstate commerce bills. Laws. We had a bill in 2011, tried to do something around internet and florists, and Governor actually vetoed it and said, you know, interstate commerce, we can't get there from here. But we actually think that this bill could get there and give those of our venues in this state who deal with tickets and talent and people coming for plays or whatever type of thing that you would have ticketed, that this would let us get there in terms of being able to ask the venue to go to a Google or Yahoo and say, hey, we're going to give you the strength of the law to shut down those advertisers. Right now, they won't do it. So thoughts or questions? And there is an amendment coming. We are interested, again, in really clarifying the language that if you have tickets, you want to sell them, use a peer-to-peer selling service. We are not looking to try to, you know, get into that mix. This is really about those folks who are selling inventory that they have no contractual relationship or a physical inventory in their own possession to sell.
Questions for Representative Parrish? Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Parrish, so I think I'm on board with what you're talking about there to stop the people from selling tickets before and to allow people to StubHub or whatever tickets back and forth. But there's a Section 3 in here. It says, before selling an admission ticket to a person, a reseller or authorized reseller shall show the person an inventory of the spaces available, blah, 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 all that. That kind of makes it impossible for me. That means I can't sell Dan my ticket unless I show him a map of the Rose Garden and all the seats that are available, which is pretty much impossible for anybody to just for any just Joe consumer to do, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Nierman, no. You know, if you get issued tickets, you know a seat number and a row number typically come assigned to a seat. If it's general admission, it's general admission. And that, I think that's, that we believe when Jennifer Williams and I crafted this bill 2 years ago, that we felt that that was adequate enough that you wouldn't have to have the floor plan. But if you just say, hey, I've got, you know, K, row K, you know, seat 13, that you actually have a seat that somebody's going to get to. What's happening now is somebody goes and buys from one of these sites. They didn't have the ticket. People actually show up. And I'm really sorry. I forgot to pass these out. This is from the folks who manage the Portland Center from the Arts. I'll give this to committee services. But what's happening now is people, you know, actually put cash money to one of these folks and show up at the venue thinking that they have a ticket, not knowing that what seat they were supposed to have, just knowing that they were supposed to go to will call, and they get to will call and they've spent hundreds of dollars and there's no seat there for them. So, you know, imagine someone from your community driving up to Portland to go see a play and, you know, spends money online thinking they went to a site like Keller Auditorium and get their tickets and get there and nothing. I mean, that was their date night or their money that they, and it's, some of these venues are, you know, the, not cheap in terms of the cost to consumers. And Keller and those folks, or Rose Garden, none of them have any obligation to, you know, say, hey, we're going to refund the customer because the transaction was done with some guy in Texas in his basement, you know, selling you tickets. Yeah. So, again, the goal is not to control the internet this way, but it's to provide some language in our statute that would let those auditoriums and venues go back to, you know, a search engine and say, hey, you need to not let this guy advertise. He, you know, this fake Keller Auditorium website shouldn't be the first thing that pops up in a Google search because they're paying to advertise and be there searching that listing, selling you tickets. They have no, you know, what I would say ethical obligation right now, but certainly no potential legal obligation to have tickets to sell you.
Can I follow?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Parrish, I think maybe I'm just either I'm not understanding the wording here because I don't think I'm picking a fight with you on the actual intent of the bill here. But it says before selling a ticket, the reseller shall show the inventory of the seats available to, and at the time set for the entertainment event to which the ticket is admission. So I think what you're saying is that I have to show you that I have seats for row K, 13, and 14. That's your intent right there, right?
Well, and so if you're listing that on Craigslist and you advertise that you have, you know, whatever seat numbers, Jennifer Williams and I felt like that met, this language met that. And again, we are going to be clarifying some of this because our goal is not for you to be able to, you know, have to jump through a bunch of hoops if you have your, you know, season seats and you can't get to the Blazers game to not be able to sell those tickets. So so there is going to be a little bit of a cleanup on that. But the goal is that you actually know where you're seating someone, or if it is general admission, to be able to say, this is what you have. And that somebody knows that I've paid $100, even if I paid a marked up to $150 for a ticket that was selling for $50, but that I still have a surety that the ticket's there, I can actually go see the venue, and I actually have a seat waiting for me at the end of the day.
Yeah, I just...
Paul?
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just... That just, to me, that looks legally problematic there. It looks like that I have to show you the inventory of every available seat in there. That's just the way that I'm reading it. I wonder if we can't.
And we're talking about, Representative Merriman, we're talking about for, so when Keller Auditorium, when I go online to go buy a ticket from them, they actually can show me all the seats that are available. I get to choose my seat. So again, this bill is not about peer-to-peer. The way this is written is such that we're talking about a venue who's got talent that's coming, or a play or something that's coming. They know what inventory they have. They're able to show that. What's happening on the fake Keller site is they're saying, well, we're just going to sell you a ticket. You're going to pay whatever. You don't get to actually see what ticket or seat that you have. So a real auditorium could actually meet the test of this, that they actually have a way to show someone, if I buy Cirque du Soleil tickets, I know exactly what I'm buying because their software generates and says, here's what, in your price range, here's the seats that are available. Which ones do you want? Right now, none of these fake kind of scammer sites, you can't do that because they don't actually have a ticket to sell you. So this actually then for those who are legitimate retailers, they like this language because they know exactly where they're going to sell you a seat.
Can I follow up? Yes, thank you, Chair. Representative Parrish, I'm not worried about Keller Auditorium, and I'm not worried about, is it Ticketmaster would be one of the companies that Keller Auditorium might subcontract sales of tickets to? Because I agree, they can share information pretty readily, and so they can produce an inventory of available seats. So I'm talking about just me selling my tickets on the Internet. So I bought some tickets, or I have season tickets to the Blazers, and I can't go that night or whatever. Am I a reseller under this in Section 3 on this bill here?
We did not, Madam Chair, Representative Niren, when we crafted this, no, we do not consider that this applies to sort of that peer-to-peer reselling of a ticket. We're talking about people who are in this business, and this is their, actual the business that they do, not the individual. And for that purpose, we are going to be clarifying that. I know Paul Cosgrove represents StubHub, and he was in here last time around to sort of protest this. And so we're waiting on an amendment that meets that language test so that we really can clarify. Our goal is not the guy who has a set of, seats that he can't go to the Blazers game that he wants to sell on Craigslist or any other peer-to-peer type of selling. Some of those folks, like a StubHub, they actually do become a second or even third tier sort of contractual reseller of tickets. They work with our stadiums, our sports stadiums here, like the Beavers and University of Oregon or whatever, and there's extra tickets, and they want to work to move some of those out. So, but again, that's sort of a contractual relationship, right? Even with a firm like a StubHub, where one of those Research Stadium says, "Hey, we've got excess tickets. We want you to move these." They actually then have a relationship about selling those. We're talking about the people who really have no connection at all selling a product they don't have any rights to sell.
Can I follow one more?
Sure. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in Section F of the existing legislation, it defines a reseller means a person other than the operator who conducts a resale. That would include just me selling my tickets on Craigslist, right? I would be a reseller as defined by that.
Madam Chair, Representative Nierman, I would have to check on that. I don't have an answer for you.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions, Representative Holvey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I tend to agree with Representative Nierman. I think that the bill as worded would outlaw me from selling my fabulous tickets to the chair as a person. So I'm a little worried about that piece as well. But I'm also sort of reading this bill. I'm kind of wondering if our existing statutes don't already cover all of this. That it's just kind of rewording what's already in statute.
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, when we looked at this bill in 2013, we did not think. We met with the folks who do this professionally. We met with some folks and talked to some folks about DOJ. Do they have reach, into places where people are doing this? And the answer that we got back was no, it's our current statutes aren't clear, and tightening them up would give the resellers the legitimate, venues the ability to go in and, use this as a tool to clamp down on that type of activity. So the answer was no. None of us came to the conclusion after meeting on this that we felt that the current statute solved it. Otherwise, we wouldn't be bringing it forward.
Other questions? And just for the sake of the clarity of the record, Representative Williamson's not co-sponsoring this bill.
She's not. I just didn't have a chance to get to her, but she did. She was my chief sponsor on 3510.
So okay. Just for this. I just wanted
and
to
it's
make
the
sure
exact same bill draft as the current. So no, I had not had a chance to get to her to sign on before I dropped all my bills this session.
Okay. Any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you. With that,
okay, we'll get back to committee.
I will bring Heather Wilton up. state your name for the record. And
Heather Walton. I'm the Assistant Director of Booking at the Portland Five Centers for the Arts. This is my first time doing this, so go easy on me. I'm here to, on behalf of the Portland Five Centers for the Arts, supporting this bill. We manage five venues, including the Keller Auditorium and the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. We have about 900 performances each year, and we have about 1 million patrons come through. It's very common for us to hear stories from our patrons of purchasing tickets on secondary sites and paying way above face value when they had no idea of the face value, of purchasing tickets, not receiving them, and showing up to the venue without a ticket and unable to get in. I think Representative Parrish did a nice job of describing our day-to-day life when we run into these issues. I have two letters that I have given Ms. Malone. One is from the Broadway League in support of this bill, and the other is from the City of Portland. And then I believe that you have one from our director, Robin Williams. Are there any questions that I can answer?
Any questions? And like she said, go easy.
Go easy.
Right, Representative Holvey.
So very easily. So when you've had problems mm-hmm. that have been presented in the past on this, have you contacted the Department of Justice or somebody for enforcement around this and been told there's nobody breaking the law, or what's the story?
To my knowledge, we haven't. I'm going to speak off the cuff, which you're probably not supposed to do here. My guess is that we have felt like we haven't had the authority to do that, or there hasn't been any legislation that would make it illegal to sell tickets on the secondary site or sell tickets on spec. So on spec is the speculative tickets before they actually have the tickets in hand. But I'm sorry, I don't know.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just, because I remember legislation back a ways that did try to address this, and I felt like, you know, the statements that were put into statute did sort of address this, and so I don't know. I'm kind of wondering if this bill is really necessary to address this. I guess I'd have to ask the Department of Justice or somebody else whether or not our statutes already cover this issue.
Any other questions for Heather? Yes, Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. So I'm just kind of following up and trying mm-hmm. to clarify. I can't imagine if I paid $1,000 for a ticket mm-hmm. and I show up and I don't have a seat mm-hmm. and I don't even get to get in, I can't imagine that that's just left right there and you say, okay, goodbye, and that nobody's trying to follow up on
We certainly try to follow up. So in those situations, the ticket would have been sold to Joe Smith in Texas, and the person who has bought the ticket for the $1,000 has no idea that that's his name. And so there's no way to actually track if the person doesn't have the ticket or the seat location in hand. We don't have their name anywhere in the system. So we will go to every end that we can to get them a seat. If it's a promoter who's agreeable, then we'll just give them a comp seat so they don't have to pay $1,050 for their ticket. But if it's a show that's completely sold out and if all tickets have been sold, unfortunately, there's not much that we can do the night of the show. We do spend a fair amount of time following up with folks and making sure that we can make them as happy as possible in that situation. Obviously, that happens, and it's terrible, and there's nothing you can do to make their night any better. But we would offer to get them tickets for some other show. Yes.
Quick follow-up. Thank you, Chair Fagan. And so in that case, mm-hmm. I mean, everybody would assume that, yes, there is a law that deals with that. It's difficult to enforce mm-hmm. because we can't track who it is who's broke the law. But the assumption is that, yes, everybody knows someone broke the law there, not that we have to have another law to reinforce that the law is being broken.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the okay. current legal status. I'm sorry.
Okay. By order of the chair, go easy.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you.
Easy questions for Heather.
Okay.
Thank you very much. You did very well. Okay, and someone on whom you do not need to go easy, so unload it, fellas, is Paul Cosgrove. Come on up.
Madam Chair, I was going to ask the same dispensation. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing eBay, who has the subsidiary StubHub that has been mentioned briefly. It is not the only corporate ticket reseller. There are several others, and one other that's represented in the building as well. You have in the file, I think they're on OLIS already, I hope, a number of letters in opposition to this bill from Osberg and the Consumers Union, talking about how, in its current form, it really does, and I think Representative Nierman is exactly correct, it does, in fact, whether that's the intent or not, affect the ability of me as an individual ticket holder to sell on Craigslist, StubHub, or any one of these other resellers. It's overly broadly drafted. It also has, even if that problem were fixed, it has a second problem, and it was also mentioned in subsection 3 of section 1, which is there is no way, unless you happen to be contractually involved with the venue, and generally speaking, that's only one company, and that's the anti-competitive part of this, there's no way that any reseller is going to have the ability to know what the entire remaining unsold inventory of a venue is, which means that the first person to have that contract with that venue locks everybody else out, which is anti-competitive and anti-consumer. The major venues, generally speaking, have used Ticketmaster, and there some of these bills around the country, in fact, were sponsored by Ticketmaster. I'm not suggesting that this one is, but it has the same effect as sort of locking out any of the competitors, and that's why StubHub has a concern. So we think it's way overbroad. But the second issue, and this is one that Representative Holfley correctly honed in on, we currently have laws. The Unlawful Trade Practices Act prohibits. It doesn't say it prohibits selling tickets that are fraudulent. It says selling property, services, or goods that are fraudulent. And certainly that is an available remedy both for the Attorney General if it's a pervasive pattern that they want to go after, or if it's an individual person, there's a private right of action. There is also some federal law that deals with fraudulent websites as well. So for two reasons, one, that we think this is far overbroad and it doesn't just deal with fraud, which none of us support, but in fact deals with legitimate transactions that I think we would all like to have be enabled, and secondly, because it's already covered by current law, that's why we oppose this bill. I'd like to point out that the major resellers, StubHub for sure, and I expect this may be true of the others as well, have a policy written, and it's the way they have consumer confidence that people will use their site, and that is they will watch their people who are putting their tickets on their site. These are individuals. You go to StubHub, put your extra tickets up there, and if you have been fraudulent in not having those tickets, you'll not only be banned from using it in the future, but StubHub will guarantee either they will go out and find tickets to that performance, or if that's not possible, they'll refund your money. It's a guarantee that gives the consumers confidence that even if one individual is trying to defraud you, we'll stand behind the website in protecting you. And I think that's the appropriate way to handle this, is to have those kinds of protections, and I think most of the resellers, certainly StubHub does. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Questions for Mr. Cosgrove?
All right. I guess it was easy.
I guess it was. Heather took all the brunt for you.
Thank you.
Great, thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 2794? Okay, seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2794. And I don't see Representative Whitsitt. Okay, we'll stand at ease for a moment. Okay, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2496. And Wendy will read us a summary of the bill, and then you can go ahead and proceed.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2496 requires vehicle repair shops to post a sign advising customers of certain rights. It requires an estimate of repairs, include a checkbox or a similar method for vehicle owners to request the return of parts replaced during repair. The bill has been found to have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact, and there are no amendments at this time.
Thank you, Chair Fagan, Vice Chairs Bueller and Rayfield. I apologize for being late. I was in the Revenue Committee. I'm Representative Gail Whitsitt, and I represent House District 56, which is the southern half of Klamath and Lake counties to the California border. I'm bringing you a bill, House Bill 2496, that would require vehicle repair shops to post a small sign delineating a consumer's rights for automotive repairs undertaken on the premises. The circumstances listed are already in statute, with the exception of requiring that any replaced parts be returned to the customer if they request them. And I do have an amendment that I will mention regarding that. Please refer to the handout of Oregon Statutes 646A.480 through 646A.495, which outlines where you will find the contents of this small sign. The sign shall be prominent and visible. The sign must also be oriented and displayed in a clear and conspicuous manner. For the purpose of this bill, clear and conspicuous means the sign must be at least 14-point typeset, contrast sufficiently in color with the background, i.e. black and white works. It also needs to appear in a manner that would otherwise clearly call a reasonable attention, person's attention to the writing. Here is an example of the wording in a contrasting black and white that any shop could make for 10 cents and place on the wall or desktop when the auto is brought in for repairs. And I think I've, here is in 14 point, so that's all the bigger it needs to be, or the same thing in 18 point if somebody wants to post it in that size. The sign will read, under Oregon law, ORS 646A.480 to 646A.495, a customer of this facility is entitled to receive, colon, number one, a written estimate for repair work that this facility performs, including the cost of parts and labor and any incidental charges, a detailed invoice of work this facility performs and of parts supplied, that's number two, and number three, any parts from a vehicle that this facility replaced during a repair if the customer requests the return, and number four, a separate authorization if this facility proposes to disassemble a vehicle or components of the vehicle in order to evaluate the vehicle's condition. The estimate must then list the parts and labor costs for evaluating the vehicle's condition and the time it would take to reassemble the vehicle if the customer elects not to have any repairs performed. So this is already in statute. Please direct any questions you might have about the requirements shown above to the manager of this facility. If you have a complaint, we're still reading on the sign, about compliance with these requirements, please contact the Oregon Attorney General's consumer hotline at, and it has a phone number, or file a complaint online with an app. We'll have a web address. I will also direct you to California and Washington statutes, which direct repair shops to return or view any unused parts if requested by the car's owner. This bill is really very simple and just puts in writing the four previous directives. At the present time, I'm sure many people don't even know that they have certain rights at the time of auto repair. It's my contention that this bill is a consumer protection and protects not only the owner of the car, but the automotive repair shop from someone who may later say they want their part back and the shop may have disposed of it already. The shop will know immediately if they should retain the part or dispose of it at the time the car is brought in for repair. The second part of the bill would require repair shops to provide a checkbox or similar designation with which the owner of the vehicle may instruct the repair shop to return any motor vehicle parts or components to the owner that the vehicle repair shop replaces or proposes to replace during the repair. This protects the garage or auto repair facility from the moment the vehicle is checked in for repairs. Everyone understands and knows what the dispensation of the parts shall be if there are indeed parts removed and replaced. It's my understanding that about 1-3% of individuals presently now actually ask for their parts back. That's according to the industry. So this should not be a huge cost. I wouldn't anticipate any more people would want parts than have been asking for them already. For parts that are retained as part of a recall or warranty, and that the garage needs to send back to the manufacturer, we have an amendment to exclude those parts. And Senator Whitsitt will talk about those. I do have a statement from the DEQ that came through this morning. I had questioned worrying about having environmental parts, something that might affect the environment. This is from the Department of Environmental Quality. There can be car parts with hazardous materials such as lead acid batteries, airbags containing sodium azide, brake pads, and mercury switches, but state and federal law would not prevent a car owner from receiving parts. For the car owner, not a business, the parts would be household hazardous waste if discarded. The car owner would still be responsible for proper disposal or recycling. I brought this bill forward as a request from a constituent in my district who had been a former Firestone Corporation employee, and he moved from California to Oregon and noticed the different automotive code for consumer protection. So I brought this for someone in my district. So I'll let you go ahead.
Madam Chair Fagan, Vice Chairs Bueller and Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsitt, representing all or most of five counties in South Central Oregon. As the representative stated, House Bill 2496 serves to both protect consumers as well as the businesses that provide automotive consumer services. Allow me to give you a few examples of what we're talking about. We purchased a pre-owned pickup from a dealership several years ago. After a week or two, hooked up the horse trailer and noticed that the taillights, or the brake lights in the pickup were not functioning. So I took it to the dealership. And they told them that the reason I took it to the dealership is because I didn't have a screwdriver with a proper blade to take the lenses out. And also, both of the lights were out, so I thought maybe there was a fuse burned out. And it was a new pickup. I didn't know where the fuses were. So I took it to the dealership. I agreed that the taillights were not covered under warranty. So after the obligatory two-hour wait, I was presented with a bill for $241.98. $13.98 were itemized for $6.99 for each light bulb. And the remaining $228 was itemized for diagnosing the burned out light bulbs. Likely, I had the legal authority to ask them for an estimate ahead of time. You know, I just didn't think to. Now, some very positive examples. I believe that Les Schwab is one of the most consumer-friendly companies in the Northwest, if not in America. And I've been a faithful Les Schwab employee for a customer for more than 50 years, as with my father before me. In fact, I even chief sponsored a Senate joint memorial for Les Schwab when he passed away. So a couple of stories regarding Schwab. We pull our stock trailers with four-wheel drive pickups. And four-wheel drive pickups use tires much more rapidly than the tires do. So than the stock trailers do. So we generally rotate the tires off the pickups after they've been run maybe used up 50 or 60% of the tread, and we use the same size tires on the stock trailer. So we ask for the tires back so that we can put them on our stock trailers. It's just a cost saving thing. A few years ago, I dropped my pickup off for the tires to be reset. I came back the next day, and they were unable to find the tires. Now, Les Schwab being Les Schwab, they found the tires. I don't know how long it took them. I don't know where they went to find them, but they found all four of my tires, and they delivered them to my farm 15 miles out of town. That's what Les Schwab does. But the fact of the matter was, had the person who took my order had me check a box that said that those tires were to be returned, they wouldn't have lost the tires because the person who took it off the pickup would have known that, or should have known that. Horses are prone to injury, in conflicts with fences, unfortunately. And Gail and I raised show horses for a long time, and you put a blemish on a show horse and you lose half of the value of it. It makes no sense. That's just the way it is. They're more like prizes than horses, I guess. So we attempt to prevent the kind of injury and loss of value by double fencing all of our fences with electric fences. So whenever I trade in a battery or get a battery off my pickup or car, if it doesn't have a dead cell in it or whatever, I ask for the battery back. We charge them up and we use them to energize our electric fences to keep our horses off the fences. Once again, simply checking a box to alert the repair shop that we might wish to keep the old battery will serve to prevent miscommunications. There's, I think, a couple of legitimate concerns regarding this bill. It is entirely possible that we should say in this sign that the owner of the vehicle is entitled to the parts, to receive the parts, or at least inspect the parts, because that might be a better thing. And our Dash-2 amendment would actually provide that change. The Dash-3 amendment adds to that exempted, warranted, or recalled parts, because the fact of the matter is that if a company recalls a part that is under warranty, then it's entirely possible that they should have that part back. Some of the questions that we understand that folks may be upset with and may bring forward. One has to do with the returning the removed and replaced parts to the vehicle owner. I checked with legislative counsel, and won't put words in the legislative counsel's mouth, but it's my understanding that there is nothing that conveys the ownership of a part from a vehicle to the repair shop when they take it off the vehicle, unless absent a contract that says the parts changed possession. So it seems a little bit strange to be very upset about not returning a part that actually belongs to the person from the vehicle you took it off of. There also may be some concern about the timing of the requirement for a estimate. And that timing under current law is sort of bizarre. It says the current statutory wording does not appear, it appears a little awkward. Current law requires that an Oregon repair shop must provide a written estimate of repair parts and reassembly costs to the vehicle owner prior to the owner making the final payment on the repairs. So it doesn't really provide that the repair shop has to give the estimate to the owner before they begin the repairs, only before it's paid for. I would imagine that I don't know the reason why, but I would guess the reason why for that wording is that sometimes you may authorize the repair shop to work on your car over the telephone or by fax or whatever, and you may not be able to sign off on the form. So for that reason, but this the point is, though, that this bill doesn't change that. Again, according to legislative counsel, this bill does not address that issue. It should be, but it doesn't. Other states such as Washington and California have nearly identical disclosure laws to the one provided by House Bill 2496. So it's our understanding that some folks may be concerned about the cost of complying with these provisions, but the same provisions apply in Washington and in California with a total population of around 50 million people, and we have about 4 million people in Oregon. So it would seem that the companies who also serve customers in those other states would already have formatted the minimal forms and signs required to do this bill, and perhaps we're missing some significant thing, but I can't imagine how it can be terribly expensive to put up a little sign in paper about 8x10. We understand that some folks may believe that this bill raises safety issues for Oregonians. I submit why would it raise safety issues for Oregonians if it doesn't in Washington and California? It's the same bill. It's not nearly as restrictive as the actual bills, actual laws in California and Washington.
DEQ, regarding DEQ.
And so we also understand that some folks may raise safety issues, and it would seem that any safety issue, again, that would potentially occur as a result of return of a part to a vehicle owner in Oregon would also be a safety issue for people in Washington and California. So what, if anything, makes Oregon customers more liable to potential safety issues than customers in those other states? We might even ask facetiously, but why a company that provides services in Washington, California would treat Oregon consumers with less respect than they extend to customers in those other states? We have also heard that some folks are concerned that this bill could result in significant job losses in Oregon. That outcome is certainly not our intent. And while listening to well-intended testimony in opposition to this bill, please keep in mind that existing laws in Washington, California are much more stringent than those proposed by House Bill 2496. Businesses that serve nearly 50 million people who live and work in our two neighbor states are required to post nearly identical signs. We have been unable to document problems relating to increased costs, job losses, court charges, insurance company claims regarding ownership of replacement parts, or the occurrence of rampant environmental contamination. We look forward to any documented discussion that identifies how this bill will adversely affect Oregon businesses in Oregon, California, in Oregon, or jobs for that matter. And it's a pretty simple little bill. It's a consumer protection bill. I think it also protects the repair shops and to make clear what is it, the expectation of the consumer and the service provider. And we would urge you to favorably vote on this bill.
Thank you very much. And just so that I'm clear, which I had actually told the members we might vote on this today. So you guys have, so as sponsors, you have a dash 2 and a dash 3 that we don't have yet today. So we actually couldn't work this today if we wanted to.
Okay. They were supposed to put them in? No? Okay.
Okay. No problem. Okay. I just wanted to clarify for committee members. Okay. Any questions? Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. Just an enforcement question on how would, the signage, how would it be enforced? And did California and Washington, when they passed, posting the sign, did they report or indicate any sort of increased cost by sending people out to actually audit to make sure the signs are up?
Representative Stark, I don't know the answer to that question. I would not anticipate any significant cost. Legislative fiscal, obviously, this bill has a negative, neutral fiscal on it, so I assume no one has brought that issue up. But I will trust legislative fiscal's response.
Fair enough.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Holley.
Thanks. I'm just looking at the statutes, and it looks like this is it following under the Unfair Trade Practices Act?
Madam Chair, Representative Holby, I had actually attempted to get in touch with legislative counsel this morning to find out the answer to that question. I believe he may be in the room today. We have been doing the low carbon fuel standard on the Senate floor for the last 4 hours, and so I have not.
Taking so long. Oh.
Crept out.
Is he here? Is Sean here?
He was supposed to be here. Legislative counsel.
We had asked.
He's here. He's here.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So perhaps you
would
could
like
ask
to come up.
Yeah. I was just trying to address the enforcement. How it gets enforced.
Thank you. State your name for the record, and if you want to go ahead and jump in and address that question, feel free.
Chair Fagan, Sean Brennan for Legislative Counsel, and to address Representative Holby's question, yes, this is subject to the UTPA. It's under 646-608. There's a private right of action for people who have ascertainable losses related to a violation of this statute. It's also enforceable by the AG if they discover a pattern.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Did you have a question, Rep. Neerman?
No.
Okay. So I had first of all, thank you for bringing this forward. I'm a big fan of posting requirements. I actually, you've definitely gone very modestly with how small you require it to be posted. Even the 20 point, I'm picturing myself in a Les Schwab, surrounded with the smell of popcorn and rubber tires, which is kind of that nice combination in Les Schwab. And I probably just wouldn't even, at 20 point, probably wouldn't notice something up on the wall, which is not a criticism. I mean, I understand you're trying to make it narrow. As you're aware, Boley actually creates the poster that then businesses can download for free. And but you know, but it's a little bit more conspicuous. It's kind of large and actually kind of, you know, it kind of looks like an official poster. And then business can download it for free and post it. Would you be, I mean, and I wouldn't propose to make this stop the bill. We could certainly, I'm assuming there's probably, I'm looking at the Senate co-sponsor, I would imagine, maybe looking out on the Senate side, but actually maybe directing the AG's office to design a downloadable poster just exactly like Boley does, something that's even larger, they could download for free, but that it would kind of be uniform throughout so that if somebody sees it in one repair shop, it kind of looks just like when you walk into any, you know, at work, when you go into the break room, you see the Boley poster that you see at every business everywhere, because it's just kind of Boley does that every year. So just a totally an idea, but I wouldn't propose that as an amendment on this side to stop your bill, but maybe something to consider on the Senate side to have the AG's office actually design a downloadable poster.
Chair Fagan, I think that's a very legitimate request. I think that since Representative Whitsitt and I both sat on the full Ways and Means Committee, we're perhaps sensitive to fiscals.
Okay, yeah, I was actually disappointed to see Aaron not sneak out, because it would see something that you wouldn't think that it would take that much. I'll design a poster for him. Just give me like a clip art and a Photoshop and go to town. Okay, any other, you wouldn't want me to. I'm not artistic at all. Any other questions? Great, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And so, Mr. Dewey, you didn't mark whether you're, what's that?
I said, can I stay longer?
Yeah, do you want to stay? Mr. Dewey, you didn't mark whether you were opposed or neutral, or because I kind of want to call a panel up that's similarly situated, but did you?
I'm similarly situated, but I'm going to be very happy to work with these fine people.
Okay, so I will call up Daryl Fuller, Mike Dewey, and Dave Reinhardt. You kind of checked it on the edge of against and neutral. Okay.
Always hard to tell where they're at.
Yes, apparently when they check it on the line. We'll go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed in whatever order you see fit.
You want to go first?
Sure.
Sure.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Northwest Auto Trades Association. In terms of the tough question scale, I'm okay with medium rare, if that's okay with you guys. I certainly wouldn't want to be Cosgroved, although you guys did seem to treat him pretty well today. So I appreciate that. The Northwest Auto Trades Association is opposed to the bill as written. Certainly the amendments that they suggested, which we haven't seen yet, may alleviate some of our concerns. And we did discuss, I've had meetings with both the Whitsitt. The notion of the Department of Justice provided a poster is one of the thoughts that we had as well. Let me provide a little bit of context. In 2009, the newly elected Attorney General John Kroger put together a work group that included new car dealers and repair shops and consumer groups and the Department of Justice. And we looked at the complaints that were being filed with the Department of Justice against repair shops and the complaints that happened over and over and over again that were causing problems for consumers. And the result of that work group is the underlying statute 6464A480 that you look at now, that you see now, that this bill is amending. That is a consumer set of consumer rights that we're very proud of, because we championed it in the legislature and we thought it was a really good idea to provide these kind of protections to consumers. So the Northwest Auto Trades Association supports the idea of good consumer protection legislation. That being said, we don't support this bill for a couple of reasons. First of all, I want you to imagine, if you will, a repair shop, whether it be a Les Schwab or whether it be one of our members, that is working really hard to follow the law and to do the right things, that understands these rights and complies with them. A notice for the consumer is not necessary, because the repair shop is providing them with all of their statutory rights. We provide them with the estimates. We do the things that we're required to do. Now, I want you to imagine for a second that there's a repair shop out there that is not following the law, that is not providing estimates, and that doesn't care what the statute says. What are the chances that they're going to post a notice in their repair shop to let their customers know what their rights are? What we have is a bill that will require the good guys to do something new, albeit not much. It's just posting a piece of paper. All right, but it doesn't go anywhere towards providing information to the people that aren't getting their rights, because those shops aren't going to post it in the first place. So while we understand the intent of posting the notice, we don't believe it'll solve any of the problems that it's intended to solve. When I first saw this bill, when it was introduced in the huge stack of stuff that we got earlier this month or last month, one of my first phone calls was to the Department of Justice. And I asked them, is this a significant problem? And as you guys know, the Department of Justice Consumer Protection and Financial Fraud Division has a very sophisticated system in which they track complaints. Every year we see the top 10 list of complaints against consumers and what consumers are complaining about. And within the auto industry, they have subcategories of the kinds of complaints they're getting over and over again against car repair shops. And so I asked them, where is not getting their parts back among the complaints that consumers are having? It happens so rarely they don't even track it. So we've not been convinced with figures, with statistics, with information from consumer protection agency or from consumer groups like Osberg or the Consumer Union. Nobody has come to us to identify that there is a statistically significant problem that needs to be solved by the legislation. I'm not saying that people don't have bad experiences with car dealers sometimes or with repair shops. I mean, it's going to happen. But we can't pass a law for every bad experience that somebody has. Senator Whitsitt told a story to you that he told me about getting the light bulbs replaced in his truck, which was just a horrendous experience, and I understand that. But I want you to understand that nothing in this bill would have changed what happened to Senator Whitsitt when he had that bad customer service experience. He acknowledged that he knew he could have asked for a written estimate but just didn't think about it. I can't imagine that a sign on the wall would have encouraged him to ask for that, and he didn't get his light bulbs back because he didn't ask for them. We have surveyed our members, and we have not found a single member of our association or repair shop at all, and we don't have an exhaustive list, so I apologize for that, where anybody has refused to return parts or allow customers to see parts that have requested it. I am sure there may be some repair shops out there that don't, but consumers have the right to go where they want to go when they get their car repaired. So if you want your parts back, when you go to the repair shop, say, I want my parts back. And if they say, we don't do that, I guarantee you there's another repair shop just down the road that would be happy to return your parts. So in the absence of any evidence, let alone overwhelming evidence, that this is a significant consumer issue, we simply don't believe the bill has reached that threshold of needing any sort of statutory remedy. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I think we'll hear from the whole panel before we get to questions. So Mr. Reinhardt or Mr. Dewey?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mike Dewey on behalf of the Oregon Auto Dealers, the new car dealers. And I apologize to the good senator and representative. I've been out for the past 2 weeks, and so I haven't had an opportunity to speak to them about this bill. And so in no way am I trying to sandbag them in terms of what I'm going to say. But I did not put neutral for or against, because I think there are ways to make this bill work. I mean, obviously, the car dealers, the repair shops have certain requirements in statute. And you have before you testimony that our office submitted, I think it was last Thursday. It's on OLIS. It's not significant. I'm not going to read it. I still have some questions about the 4 points in terms of what the poster might look like and the requirements about how you check a box, why there's some information about the vehicle, and I'm still trying to figure out in the in this bill why that might be appropriate. But this bill isn't, I don't think it's going to move today, so we're happy to have those conversations to get it in better shape. Mr. Fuller did speak about the statutes, and in my testimony, if you want to try and put yourself to sleep, if you're not sleeping, you can read the statutes. They're replete with requirements for the auto dealers, repair shops, dealing with repairs, estimations, written consent, and the like in 646A. Don't read the statutes. But nonetheless, there are there's a plethora of requirements. We can comply with another requirement. The auto dealers actually provide the forms for the dealers. And if you bought a car lately, it's almost like closing on a house. I mean, there are 40, 50 different pieces of information you need to sign.
So we can figure out a way to work with this, but nonetheless, we think it needs some work. We do appreciate very much the information or the amendment, and we haven't seen the amendments. I haven't yet. I assume they're perhaps on OLIS. Regarding recall and warranties, we have our contractual responsibilities with the manufacturers in terms of particularly on recalls. They want to know what is happening to a part very quickly. And so we are going to provide that to the manufacturer as opposed to having the consumer take that particular part back, because it's very important at the end of the day for public safety. So, Madam Chair, I'll stop there, and then if there are questions, be happy to answer those questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan, members of the committee. I'm Dave Reinhart, representing the aforementioned and multiple times mentioned Les Schwab. Les Schwab is an Oregon-born and based company that has been long committed to doing what's right for its customers. In general, Les Schwab opposes any new regulatory proposal that does not help deliver value to our customers. As such, we have some concerns about the regulations proposed in House Bill 2496. We believe that the bill's parts return provisions pose significant environmental and safety concerns and would raise consumer prices for Oregonians. We worry where the return parts would end up. Batteries contain very caustic materials, as has been mentioned. Ride control components that we work on are filled with high-pressure gas and oil. All pose safety and environmental issues. Tire disposal would become a customer nuisance, or could become a customer nuisance, with no real guarantee that the tires are recycled or repurposed. Now, we've talked here about increased costs. The increased costs for Oregon consumers would happen this way. The remanufactured calipers that we install require the existing caliper to be a core for the remanufacturing process. If the customer were to keep this part, the price of repair would increase dramatically, and that has happened in California. If you ask for a part back, you have to pay a higher cost for the new part that is put in your car. The remanufactured steering components we install require the existing items to be a core of the remanufacturing process. If the customer again were to ask to keep this item, the price would go up and go up dramatically. A personal note. A repair shop once asked me, up in Portland, asked me if I wanted the old parts returned when they were done their repair. I wouldn't know one part from another. I wouldn't know a good part from a bad part. But I said, yeah, I'd love them back. Now, I don't know why I said that, really, at the time. It may have been that I just didn't want to look like some rube that they could fleece in some way. I point out that I wasn't at the Les Schwab dealer at that time. So I got the parts. They were back in the trunk of my car, and I lugged them home. And they stayed in my garage for a very, very long time. And they stayed there. I just didn't know what to do with them. Now, I'm as green as the next guy, unless the next guy's Kermit the Frog. I can't say to you now that those parts didn't end up in the waste stream and that they didn't go out in my garbage. I believe that if there is a check provision for recycle or old parts, that you will have more people asking for these old parts to be returned. And many of them, like me, won't be able to tell you precisely why. All that said, we understand that the sponsors of this bill simply want to bring Oregon's return parts policy in line with our neighbors. It's our belief, after looking at the California and Washington state policies, that the provisions in the bill are a bit different, are a little more severe in some ways. And we would be happy to sit down with the sponsors of 2496 and bring these in true alignment, if that's wisdom of the committee. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
May I add, just for a minute, if your holler was waste management, everything would have been taken care of.
Questions for this panel. Representative Rayfield.
So, first of all, Mr. Dewey, I appreciated the humor in your letter. I do have trouble sleeping, so I did review the statutes for you. So
good. And I'm sorry.
And so, one of the things that I would probably address to Mr. Fuller is how does and actually all of you guys how does posting a simple sign harm your industries?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Rayfield, first I neglected to mention that I do have testimony on OLIS as well, and unlike Mr. Dewey, mine's written in beautiful prose and has a real cliffhanger at the end, so I encourage you to read it. It will not have a substantial, if any, impact on the industry to have to post that sign. It is, and I mean no disrespect, but it's more of a nuisance than anything else. The only thing that might concern us in that regard is the fact that it is a UTPA violation, which provides a private right of action. While it is not common, it is not rare for there to be attorneys or shops that look for UTPA violations as part of their business. I spent quite a bit of time working with the New Car Dealers Association, where they commonly settle nuisance complaints with a payment rather than going to court to prove that they're correct. Because it costs less and it doesn't get in the newspapers to just settle out of court. Things like a framed notice that wasn't in the waiting room that was supposed to be there because it fell behind a couch and the repair shop didn't notice it becomes part of a nuisance complaint that can be expensive for small businesses. And again, I understand that those are rare, but those sort of things make my clients nervous.
Chair Fagan, Representative Rayfield, I don't think it would hurt. It wouldn't help. Our concern is mainly with the checkbox, which is, as I understand it, in California and Washington, is not on the posting notice, and it's not in that statute at all, nor is it required by the states.
And I might just add, if I may, Representative and Madam Chair, I would agree we would abide by the statute. It's not going to be difficult to post a sign. That's not going to be the issue. We are never favorable about unlawful trade practice angles, just in terms of how those can go. Mr. Fuller's correct about settling as opposed to going to court. So that obviously concerns us. I do this a lot with on the healthcare side about just incremental on insurance regulations, and pretty soon you look at the statute and you go, wow, we've got a lot of stuff on the statute. And this is an issue of at what level does this arise to? But we can handle it. We think we can fix it. But we're not going to, I mean, it's not something that we're going to oppose here today. I would say that and I have to be careful. When you go to a repair shop, most of us are going to be like this young man right here. We hope we go to a very reputable entity because at the end of the day, we're not going to be quite sure how it all works out. That's why we have a statute that is fairly significant already on written estimates and when they occur, when they can do the work, when you're going to be taking the car apart. And there are going to be surprises. And you just don't know until you get into the guts of the vehicle to find out what the issue is. And it may cost you a few hundred dollars or more just to find that out, unfortunately.
Madam Chair, could I?
One quick follow-up.
There was a question earlier about why the statute was written in such a way that you're not required to give the estimate until final payment, and I can answer that question just for the information of the committee. The reason why, when we were constructing this statute in 2009 with the Attorney General's office, it is rather commonplace in the state of Oregon, and I'm certainly an example of that with AJ's Auto Repair here in Salem. When I have a problem with my car, it never happens when AJ's is open. When I have a problem with my vehicle, it always happens in the evening or on the weekends. So I have my car delivered to the dealership, and I stick my keys down the little hole with a little note saying what's wrong with it, and they know to call me the next day and say, here's the problem, and they tell me what the problem is over the phone, and they tell me how much it's going to cost over the phone, and I can authorize it over the phone. Now, I can ask them to email or fax an estimate to me if I want to, and they're required to give it to me if I ask for it, but many people have a long-term relationship with their repair shops where I don't need to see something in writing. So I don't worry about that written estimate until I go in to pay for it. So it provided that flexibility for those people that didn't want to have an invoice, that the law didn't require a repair shop to give one to somebody who maybe is traveling and doesn't have access to a computer or a fax machine, and that you can give those that sort of information over the phone rather than mandating in statute that it had to be in writing prior to the authorization. So that's the purpose of the statute.
Follow up.
And so you guys would be more comfortable with the checkbox that essentially says, show me my broken part, as opposed to, you know, offering or inviting folks to take their broken part?
We don't like the checkbox anyway. I mean, regardless, whether it's return or show me. It just encourages, I think, behavior that we just don't see a need to encourage. If people ask to see that, we'll give them the part, we'll show them the part, and we'll hope that they can understand. But in fact, we'll work hard to ensure that they understand.
Madam Chair and Vice Chair Rayfield, our position is that the checkbox creates a statutory requirement to solve a problem that there's no evidence it exists. Yet, if you want to see your parts, I would guess that less than a fraction of a percent of people that want to see or keep their parts are told no, and that those repair shops are not going to post the notice and let people know. So the fact that there's a statute that would require them to do that is not going to benefit that small number of people that don't get them back, because the repair shop's not going to let them know that they have that right.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. I think most folks aren't aware of these rights.
And we have a couple more questions, but just kind of as a comment, Mr. Fuller, I appreciate your example about your longstanding relationship with AJ's. I just want to make a point that if we wrote a consumer protection law such that they satisfy, you know, you guys are kind of three middle-class guys that are sophisticated enough to be lobbyists in front of the Oregon legislature, we wouldn't have a consumer protection committee if we thought, oh, well, as long as Daryl can figure this out, everybody's good. There's a very vulnerable population out there that, you know, that ends up with as a mom with a baby in the back seat stuck on the side of, you know, 205, and the tow truck takes their car somewhere in particular, and they aren't exactly aware of these rights. So I just think that, you know, that's the reason we have a consumer protection committee, is for folks who aren't even aware that we have a state legislature, let alone, you know, these sort of sophistications.
Chair, I think you're right. They're state senators.
Yeah, yes, correct.
Yeah, Chair Fagan, I yield to no one in my vulnerability.
Okay, well.
Especially when it comes to automobiles. So my sophistication goes out the door pretty quick at AJ's front door.
So, okay.
Thank you.
Representative Stark and then Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. A couple questions regarding your testimony on Les Schwab's. And personally, I'm kind of a brand insistence when it comes to tires, and I'm a Les Schwab guy, and so I'm a big fan of theirs. So I have two different questions here, but we'll take them one at a time. With you guys being all over the place, you have Washington and California, your testimony implied or said that costs are likely to go up as a result of this bill. But there's been similar things there. So did you see an increase in requests for parts back and an increase in costs in California and Washington?
I can't answer that specifically, but I can answer it having looked at the California regulations.
And what the California regulations say is that if you are returning a core part of the caliper or the thingamabob, that the auto or the repair shop or the Les Schwab can charge you more for the new part, because part of the cost that they get from the manufacturer of that is predicated on their returning the used part, the core part, to the manufacturer. So if I'm being clear, they...
So, follow up?
Sure. Yes.
But my understanding is that you can already do that. I mean, that shops can already charge it, because there's a number of items they already, you know, if you request it back, or you even pay sometimes a deposit, if you're purchasing a part, taking it home and replacing it and taking it back. There's a core charge for a number of those things already.
If you take it back, there will be more core charges, though.
Okay.
The more people that want these parts back, and we believe this checkbox would encourage that, the higher the costs are going to be for that customer, because they're going to pay for a new part, and they're not going to have basically a trade-in on that part.
And one final question.
Please go.
And I'm trying to reconcile what I heard, Representative say, and your last few statements about there's minimal impact other than posting a sign, with what your testimony made it sound like, these parts aren't currently by law, that they can't get them back, or your testimony made it sound as though it's not required that you give the parts back currently if they're asked for them, whereas that this would require it to be. I'm trying to reconcile. It seems like some are saying, well, they already have to give them back, and some are saying we don't actually, but we by practice do. What is the current law on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Stark, under current law, a repair facility is not required to return those parts. Now, that's notwithstanding Senator Whitsitt's comments with legislative counsel, where he contends that the parts that are removed from the vehicle are legally owned by the vehicle owner unless there's an agreement between the owner and the repair shop to take ownership of those parts to dispose of them. So that would be, those of you that are attorneys on the committee could maybe do a better job of answering that than I can, but because I'm not an attorney, I can tell you there's no specific statute that requires us to return them if asked for. So I would suggest that a repair shop could have a business model where they say, we won't return the parts even if you want them. I think that would be a pretty poor business model, but I suppose that one could exist. My testimony was that I can't find a repair shop that I have had contact with that won't return them yet. The instances of repair shops that don't return them, I think, is monumentally small. But this issue does bring up another issue that, if the bill is going to move forward, that I think probably needs to be nuanced in amendments, and that is when the parts are asked for. And the reason why that's important is we are required by law to provide an estimate on the cost of repair. And if the customer asks us for an estimate and we're assuming that we're going to be able to return the cores of those parts we're replacing back to the manufacturer as part of that repair, and so we get that the cost of the core for the incoming part versus the cost of the core for the returning part is a wash for the consumer. So we've given them an estimate that it's going to cost them $350 to make this repair, and then they come into the shop to pay for it and say, oh, by the way, I want my parts back. Well, all of a sudden, our estimate now is no longer valid, because it's now $450 to do that same repair, because we no longer have the benefit of returning that core to the manufacturer and getting that wash. So again, if the bill is going to move forward, I think it would be important to somewhere mention in the statute that if somebody wants their parts back, that they need to let the repair shop know that before they receive an estimate, so that we can give them an accurate estimate on the cost of repair based on the fact that the cores are not going to be returned to the manufacturer as part of that repair.
Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. Could systematic noncompliance with aspects of this bill form the basis for a class action lawsuit?
Mr. Dewey's the only attorney, so he has to answer that one.
This is going to depend on what happens to 2,700 on the so on the...
I have no idea at this point. I mean, I haven't even thought of that. And quite frankly, that wouldn't be an argument we would use to try and get this bill ready for prime time. You know, quite frankly, I think what occurs here, and I understand the good senator and the good representative where they're coming from on the parts side, you kind of have to weigh the public good here at the end of the day. And I try and go back when I have a car repaired. I think always the dealer or repair shop has said, here's the part. So you have it. You can know that something was changed out. So you see it. You've got something tangible. But I've never said I want to take that with me at any time because I would be like Mr. Reinhardt. You know, what would I do with it?
Follow-up question?
Yes.
I'm not really concerned if you would use it as an argument. I want to know if it's a possibility.
Well, we're changing the way the class is formed. We're not talking about Cypre, so it would be the issue of the class could be potentially larger. That would be the argument that we would make. If we were discussing this in that context. But, I mean, this is open to interpretation, and I don't want to get into
understand.
2,700, if I
can. Chair Fagan and Representative Bueller, I do not have an answer to that specific question, but it brings up something that we've experienced in California in the enforcement of this. Large companies with multiple franchises are a more inviting target for enforcement. And if this were open to a class action suit, would be more inviting targets to class action lawyers. And we've felt that in California.
Representative Mayfield.
I was just going to ask this question. It's going to lobby a softball here. If you follow the rules and the statute, would there be a class action lawsuit?
Well,
just a yes or a no, really.
Put me out of my misery.
It's a maybe because usually there's a difference of opinion between what the plaintiff and the defendant thinks. So I don't think it's that clear.
Agree to disagree.
Representative Rayfield, we would follow the law to the T should the legislature, in its wisdom, pass such a law. Whether that would be the wise decision is what I think we're here debating.
Just playing with
yeah.
you guys.
It's a softball for you.
And as much as I appreciate the introduction of the class action boogeyman, you know, there has to be harm to people to have a class action lawsuit. So the idea that the failure to put thumbtacks in the wall and attach them to a poster is harm, I think, is quite a bit of a stretch. So I have a couple of questions. I actually have great concern about the fact that there's no law authorizing you to keep my property. And I know that you're using euphemisms like return it to and wash, but the reality is you're reselling it. You're reselling my property to the manufacturer. And while I appreciate the argument about the cost being higher, that seems to me a great reason why I would want to have an estimate of my repairs that would say, if you want to keep your old brake pads, I don't even know if that's such a thing. I've just seen Tommy Boy, and I think there's brake pads. Then your repair is this much. If you don't want to keep your brake pads, which I think is a way to fulfill the checkbox requirement and probably not have a whole lot more consumers say they want to keep their product. So that's one point, because I actually find it to be odd that that there's a trade-in, that there's some monetary value to this, and yet you get to keep my property without any agreement that it's that you keep my property, and somehow that now that you're here defending that right when there's no express ability in statute for you to actually keep something that fully belongs to me.
Madam Chair, my only comment to that is that we're not keeping the part in our benefit. We're taking the core charge for that and returning it to the benefit of the customer. So if it's a $100 core charge, we're not keeping 25 of it and giving you 75 of it. Okay, we're returning the core for the charge, and you're getting the consumer is getting the benefit of that as opposed to us keeping it.
I mean, that's one way to look at it, but the reality is you're reselling my property back to the manufacturer.
And giving you the money.
Okay, but I should at least know that you're reselling my property. And that seems to me a great reason why you maybe would want people to know that they have a right to have a written estimate up front.
And that, Representative Fagan, is in the California statute and in the California poster, that if you want the parts back or if you want to look at the parts, you certainly have that right, but you need to serve notice that you're acting on that right at the time when you authorize the repair. And that's a bit different than going further and doing the checkbox, and that would be our concern.
Okay. I note your concerns about the check box. I still remained a big fan of the idea of the posting requirements, and I wanted to address one point that you made, Mr. Fuller, just about, oh, the AG hasn't logged any complaints, therefore the problem doesn't exist. I actually look at that as a different way. Is like, I mean, up until today, I didn't know that I could call the AG hotline. So the reality is maybe the AG hasn't logged a lot of complaints because consumers don't realize that there's an AG consumer protection hotline. I know that there's a lot of people that, you know, any kind of open-ended business, whether it's attorneys or, you know, repair shops, is people just kind of enter those with great trepidation because something's going on back there and people can't tell them exactly how much it's going to cost. And so that's a very scary thing. So the reality is when people are in kind of desperate straits, like the example I gave, somebody with a kid in the back seat, their car gets towed to a particular tow shop, I don't think that person is in a great situation to be like, well, how much do you cost? Because I might go to the guy down the street. The reality is I can't afford to then have them tow my car down the guy down the street. So to me, the fact that it is anecdotal, but given the fact that I think many consumers have at least fear, and some of that fear is based on bad experiences with repair shops, the fact that there haven't been any complaints, to me, is not evidence that there's no problem. It's maybe evidence of the fact that people don't know how to complain about a problem, which, again, to me, is great support for having a posting requirement.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and the only point that I guess I would try to clarify in case you misunderstood me or I misspoke is I don't want to suggest that the Attorney General's office doesn't get a lot of calls about repair shops. They get a lot of calls about repair shops. What they don't have is a lot of calls about people complaining that they couldn't get their parts back when they asked for them. The Attorney General does not track that complaint because there hasn't been enough for it to create a specific category for that type of complaint because they don't see them. They don't hear that kind of complaint. There are plenty of complaints around auto repair shops. We frequently make the top 10 list of complaints. Now, if you take all of those complaints versus the number of repairs that are done in the state in a year, the number of people that complain is still an extremely small number, so we think we provide good customer service to our customers. But again, I just want to clarify, I'm not saying that people don't know to call because they are calling.
Additional questions? Great. Well, I definitely hope that you will work in earnest with Representative Whitsitt. I think this is not onerous, particularly the idea of a posting requirement and letting people know their existing rights. So I hope that you will work in earnest with representatives. I am very interested in working this bill. So
we will be earnest.
Thank you. Earnest. The importance of being earnest, one could say.
So you're talking about next year?
So with that, I will close the work session. Excuse me. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2496. And is there anything else for the good of the order? All right. With that, I will close the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. The House